Okay, so I'd like to welcome everyone to the Des Plaines Public Library this evening. You know, 5 years ago, we hosted NaNoWriMo for the first time. And out of that first month of November, our writers group grew. And since then, they've been meeting at the library every month. I think that they initially started with once a month, but it quickly became once a week. True blue for 5 years. And they just finished NaNoWriMo, National Novel Writing Month, in November, and wanted an opportunity to showcase some of their work. So we're happy to give them that opportunity tonight.
My name's Ann Anderson. I'm part of the writing group, and I want to thank Chris Posinger and the Des Plaines Library for supporting us, for 5 years, and for supporting us for tonight, and bringing a lot of wonderful food. And then I also want to thank the writers group, Writers Anonymous, for helping plan this and for bringing more food and drink. And thank you to the planning group, Julie, Sheila, and Pearlie, and to Dan, who's going to be the MC, and he's going to keep you under his thumb as he keeps you down to 5 minutes reading max, and then this bell will tell you when you're finished. If you think you're going to go over 5 minutes, maybe cut something out of the middle, because you really don't want to lose your end.
Okay, so I'm going to get things started for you guys. So this is going to be a new experience for all of us. So we're all in it together, right? So first up, we have Julie Christine. She will be reading The Whisper.
Hi, everyone. This is my first open mic. So this is called A Whisper, or The Whisper. A nightmare woke Matthew, and he sat up. The abrupt motion stirred Talia. Another bad dream, she murmured. It's nothing, Talia. Go back to sleep. He kissed her on the forehead, and immediately her breath returned to its rhythmic sound. You should have died with them. The voice rang in his head with the vision he saw of Monica clutching Joseph, blood all over them. You should have died with them. He wondered if that was how the genocide started, that it started with a whisper, that this group is better than that one, that he is a cockroach, that they are cockroaches. It started with a whisper, but he reminded himself that the whisper was a lie. Matthew walked into the bathroom and placed a washcloth under the cold running water and pressed it to his face, neck, and shoulders. The scar, a daily reminder of his first family, ran diagonally across the right side of his chest, a reminder that he wasn't there to protect them. When he turned off the light, the switch glowed. The door to Tomione's bedroom was ajar, and he found his daughter asleep, stuffed animals sprawled on the floor radiating from her bed. Matthew picked them up and huddled them close to Tomione. He kissed her goodnight and closed the door behind him just enough so that the nightlight in the hallway glowed in her room. With a slight pivot, he entered the boys' room, turning the knob as quietly as he could. He opened it and saw slats of the moonlight on the floor between the two beds. Anthony's mouth was open and he was cocooned in the blanket, but when he looked to the right, he saw a mound of blankets in Benjamin's bed. Where's Ben? Matthew's heart burned. He's here somewhere, he thought. He heard the house settle. A sound of heat came through the vents, the natural sounds of the house. No footprints, no running water, no toilets flushing. Between the sounds of the house remained the space of silence and his beating heart. Matthew looked in the bathroom on the same floor. Perhaps Benjamin went in when he was checking on Tomione, but the only thing he saw was the glow of the switch, the shower curtain, reflecting in the mirror and the toilet seat. He walked inside the bathroom, moved the curtain to the side to see a few drops from the leaky faucet that shimmered on the bottom of the white porcelain tub. He turned back and peeked in his bedroom, but only Talia lay there. He would have heard Benjamin's footsteps. All of the rooms were in such close proximity to each other that awake he heard everything. At the top of the 5 steps, he looked into the living room and saw both sofas were empty. He could see from one room into another, which were separated by only a few steps. The kitchen lights were off, the kitchen table empty. He entered the kitchen through the living room and peered into the dining room where he saw his reflection between the china and glasses of the hutch. Back in the kitchen, he opened the door that led to the garage. He leaned his forehead against the cold window of the car and saw seats empty. Back in the kitchen, The sound of the furnace kicked on startled him, and he felt the warm air come through the vent above him. Perhaps he is downstairs in the basement. He had always intended to finish it, but when they had enough money raised, another child was on the way. It was for the best because their basement had flooded too many times to count. "Benjamin, Benjamin," Matthew whispered with urgency, "where are you?" There was no reply amongst the boxes, old desks, file cabinets, tables, and a rusted bike. He stepped onto the floor. The grayish-blue seal over the concrete felt cold against his bare feet. The door and the windows were all secured and closed, bolted with three locks. Benjamin was not in the basement. He went back up the stairs, taking two at a time. Benjamin's bed still remained empty. "Anthony, Anthony," Matthew whispered, grabbing his eldest son by the shoulders. "Where is your brother? Where is Benjamin?" Anthony blinked. "In bed." "He's not there." Anthony leaned on one arm. Seeing Benjamin's bed empty, he said, "I don't know. He was there when we went to sleep." Anthony rubbed his eyes. "Papa, Papa, I'm down here." Matthew got on his hands and feet and followed Benjamin's voice. Matthew pulled Benjamin from under the bed and held him tight. Benjamin wrapped his legs around his father and leaned his head into the crook of Matthew's neck. "I was looking all over the house for you." Matthew's voice was hoarse. Benjamin nodded and placed his thumb in his mouth. Matthew tisked. "You're too old for that, my son." He sat down on the bed and slid the covers to the side and lay Benjamin down. "Why were you under the bed?" "I just wanted to sleep, Papa." Matthew had the briefest of urges to become angry with his son, to yell how scared he was, and to never, ever do that again. But he didn't, and the anger passed. "Promise me you won't do that again." "I promise." "We sleep in beds." Benjamin nodded, and Matthew heard the whisper in his head. "We hide under them."
All right, thank you, Julie. And we're going to have Anderson come up next.
Skylar Rao looked away from the complicated layers of clouds below the wing and back at her own reflection in the oval window of the 737. She was 42 and looked it. Too tall, too quiet, and too dark for the guys who lived for deer season and high school football. A man could live happy at 42. Great-looking women threw themselves at men even in their 50s and 60s. Gray hair didn't matter. Pot bellies and wrinkles looked impish or distinguished. But not on women. Not on her. She was pretty enough. Not slim, but curvy in the right places. And her great asset, long, shiny black hair, hinted at exotic genes. Her mother had dropped her off at O'Hare Airport and parked the car outside departures. But before Skylar could open the door, she'd stroked Skylar's cheek. Neither one of them expressed emotion much, so the gesture had touched Skylar enough she'd taken her mother's hand, a hand with wrinkles and spots she knew almost as well as she knew her own. And then she told her mother she'd considered sending away for the genetic test that would finally explain her exact heredity. Her mother had asked, "Why would you ever do something like that?" The only answer Skylar could give was, "Why would you not?" "You know who you are," her mother smiled like she knew something Skylar didn't. "Do you know how much you look like my mother? You know, she once told me, my grandmother." "Your great-grandmother, I know, Mom, escaped from India with her lover, an English colonel, and had to live several years in Brussels, where you're going. Imagine hiding from his regiment." She laughed and looked out to where a police officer waved away a car. "But later," she told me, "her mother grew up with one of the last samurai families in a small village outside Tokyo. She told me all about how they had to wash their silk kimonos in the cold brook behind their house, and how her fingers almost froze doing it." Skylar reached for the car door. "Then another time she told me her father was a Bedouin sheik who..." "Then she told you her father was chief of the Sioux, and she was a princess who ran away with one of Custer's men." "Yes, I know, Mother. That's why I want to do it." "But that's my point, Sky. Facts define you." She reached out again, to tuck a strand of Skylar's hair back behind her ear. Why would you ever want to lock yourself into just one story? Mystery's so much more exciting, don't you think? Skylar looked away from the window reflection of her wet eyes and tried to see through the clouds below to the road where her mother drove her car and dreamed the dreams that kept her sane her whole hard life.
So that was Ann Anderson reading Skylar's story. Next up, we have Sheila.
Hello, I'm Sheila Valisano, and my title is Pictographs. Happy birthday to me. I swallowed the lump in my throat, far away from my home in Michigan, and having worked on this ranch only 2 months, I felt sorry for myself. Here I was among strangers in a tiny Colorado community with nothing to do for the weekend. Everyone had gone off to follow their own pursuits or were busy doing work on the ranch. I had time to kill and no one to spend it with. I put on my hat that was a size too big and dragged myself down to the corral to hitch up Domino, my pinto horse. At least he was glad to see me. He turned his head and nudged me as I buckled his riggings. The saddle felt stiff but comfortable enough for a few hours riding. The old wrangler who helped tend the horses had told me about a cave on the property just the other side of Bitter Mountain that had pictographs. Said hardly anybody goes up there because of the narrow trail. In his instructions, he said the trail starts just beyond the lake, and if I looked right of the big boulder, I would see an opening in the trees that would lead me there. Sounded like just what I needed to get my mind off of the exclusive pity party that I was planning to attend. The ride continued on the narrow trail. Domino was beginning to sweat. I wish I had lost the additional 10 pounds before this trip started, so it would have been a little easier on him. Too late now. We found the trail and climbed until we reached a grove of trees, where I jumped down to loosely tie Domino's reins to a tree. I stroked his damp mane in gratitude for his tenaciousness in spite of a stumble on the rocky terrain. He seemed content to stand beneath the cool tree, flicking his tail occasionally to ward off mosquitoes. Hiking up another 60 yards over more jagged stones than one could count, I reached a clearing at the mouth of a cave. The air up here was thin, and my chest was heaving rapidly as I processed as much oxygen as I could to keep from passing out. Finally, my breathing slowed, and I felt I could continue. Voices came from the cave. Probably hikers, I thought. As I entered the cave, I felt its coolness envelop me. It was about 50 degrees, a welcome relief from the dry heat outside. Too bad Domino couldn't be in here, but the slope was too steep. I was fond of telling him, "You're a horse, not a goat." The voices further in the cave were echoing off the walls, and I was anxious to meet whoever else had ventured into this small but apparently long, narrow cavern. Releasing the clip from my belt, I swiveled the attached flashlight on and proceeded further into the cave. The walls were gray and jagged. It was not a particularly pretty cave with its sandy floor that was obviously created from thousands of years of eroding stone. My step crunched and left a shoe impression. Interesting that there were no other footprints in the dust except mine. Still, I heard voices coming from deeper in the cave. The light from my flashlight skimmed the interior of the cave, where, to my delight, pictographs decorated the walls. Hunting, cooking, and sun scenes were drawn on the walls as if they were painted only days ago. One interesting image puzzled me. It was a horseman on the back of a horse with spots. The spots seemed to align with the paint pattern on Domino. You see, Domino had 3 black circles on his left flank and 2 black circles on his left shoulder. The image of the horse had the same pattern. Coincidence? Domino, a descendant? The voices grew louder as I advanced further into the cave. Maybe just beyond the next turn, I'll meet someone. Hello, I called out. The word echoed off the walls of the cave. The voices were silent. That was kind of creepy. I listened, but only heard the sound of dripping water. There was flickering light coming from a section further into the cave. I pointed the flashlight down, and still didn't see any footprints. Then I heard a sharp sound, like the strike of a match on sandpaper. I creeped around the corner, peering into the cave room from which the light glowed. There, lining the walls of the room, were the ranch hands, including the old wrangler. On a small table was a birthday cake with 23 flickering candles, one for every year I was born. Seems my mama called the ranch and told them about my birthday. My new ranch friends took a shortcut through the ranch to get here before me and came in from a back entrance. They even took the time to draw charcoal pictographs on the cave wall. On the wall in this room, they drew a wrangler with an oversized hat holding a cake with 23 candles.
All right, thank you, Sheila. Up next is going to be Pearly Best. Pearly.
Thank you. This is also my first time reading. This is titled Never in Lie, is advice to my future self. Never lie to your parents, just assume they already know the truth. Never lie to your siblings, you never know if that will be the match to finally set that bridge ablaze. Never lie to your significant other, some lies can never be forgiven. Never lie to your best friend, even if they think they have the personality to wear plaid and stripes together. Never lie to your teachers, they already passed the class. Never lie to your college roommate, they have access to all your belongings. Never lie to a stranger, it's just a waste of time. Never lie to your doctor, you only hurt yourself in the end. Never lie to your dentist, they will drill anyway. Never lie to the law, they will find out the truth eventually. And never lie to the IRS, they are the CIA. Never lie to your boss, that's just a given. And never lie to your pets, they didn't do anything wrong. Never lie to your landlord, your parents charge rent too. Never lie to your neighbor, they may never return that tool set. And never lie to your lover, they know your biggest secret of all. And never lie to your higher power, they too already know the truth. And never lie to your children, they really do remember all the broken promises. And above all, never lie to your own self, that's the worst lie of all.
All right, thank you, Pearly. Next up is Clarissa Jenshin. She'll be reading Beautiful Day. Clarissa.
This is just something I sent to my granddaughter, who's in Colorado, and hikes in all the beautiful mountains. And she's always sending me pictures. So I sent this to her. A beautiful day in Illinois. A morning like all mornings. Sleepy eyes, full body stretch, then a very weak up and at 'em, Pilates, start laundry, breakfast, ho-hum, and another ho-hum. Read the news, do a chore, then glance out the window at a bright sunshine and discover a 50-degree Fahrenheit day on December 3rd. A thought forms, a quite foreign thought, but why not? Today I'm going to do what I feel like, not what I'm supposed to. With a nutty snack bag, I'm out the door and headed to the forest preserve, feeling lighter somehow. The first two groves are closed. Amazing. I didn't know nature, wilderness, grass and trees, and fields and sky could be locked up. Or is it locked down? Driving as far in as I can to park, I walk not on asphalt, but across the golden field of tall grass bent low and turned yellow by the sun and the season. The crunch of each step brings memories of invigorating childhood explores, filled with discovery and imagination. Suddenly I realize I am smiling broadly and stop to enjoy the bright sun on my face, the crisp air in my lungs, and the cool breeze on my face. Happy. I feel very, very happy. At my feet, I notice a small mound of mud around a snake's entrance to home. Just one of the many living creatures I seldom see. Not far away is a body of water surrounded by the yellow marsh. In the distance, a full line of trees so very dark brown, naked of their leaves, their twigs like lace against the bright blue sky. There is life here, unseen, and the colors of autumn, not drab, but a kaleidoscope of browns from gold to cinnamon to chocolate and more, fresh and glorious. Turning all directions, I am lovingly nestled in freedom to stay or go, to just be. My soul expands. Each discovered view is beautiful. Flat Illinois is beautiful. I climb hills with care, for each step must be a careful one, for there are unexpected holes and rises and mushiness in natural land. My reward is a bush, a weed, a dried flower, a blushing plant, the shimmering sun setting ablaze a pile of leaves. Soon, too soon, that sun begins to set on autumn hues, still there, but unseen until the morning's light.
All right, thank you very much, Clarissa. Up next, we have Sabrina Savra-DiCarlo. Sabrina, please come up.
Hello, everyone. My name is Sabrina Savra-DiCarlo, and I hope we're all keeping warm in here, though it's very chilly outside. I'm just going to say this is my first time reading in a long time because it kind of reminds me of high school speech team, but this is more fun. This is Touched. What do you bring to the home of the grieving? The Van Etten home stands silent among bare November trees. Amy shivers, puffs of warm breath rendered insubstantial by the cold, her fingers numb on the sympathy card she bears. Where is everybody? Her phone rings. Hello? Hey, got tied up, sorry. And Annie swallows a choke. If my brother answers, could you stay with him? Amy knocks. Michael answers with flushed cheeks and sleet must brown hair. What are you doing here? Seeing you, friend? Sorry, stupid me. He moves aside. Come on in, it's cold. Every surface in the living room sprouts floral arrangements in various states of life, filling the air with faded scent. Amy looks at Michael and the newspapers on the coffee table, catching a headline printed on the top. Local mentally unstable man faces charges for mother's murder. She shuffles the paper to the bottom of the pile and lays her coat over, her hands atop her coat. I wish I'd been able to come to Grandma Betty's funeral. Michael looks from Amy's card and smiles, eyes sad. You're here now. How are you? Failing my last year of high school? He shrugs. How's college? Amy grins. Crazy busy. How you like it? Michael smirks. Yet laughter suffocates too soon in this flowery air, and Michael hangs his head. Amy takes his hand. They hold, grateful. Michael suddenly snatches his away. Wait. Want anything to eat? I'm fine. You're pale. Amy rises. I'll get us something. Congealed, reheated lasagna. Amy picks at it. She feels eyes on her. Her purple sweater's pulling too snug, or the neckline shifted, or... Amy smooths her bob and looks up. Michael, staring. Amy blushes. He drops his eyes, fixated with his uneaten food. Amy shifts in the chair. Strange. She feels fat, yet flattered. She longs to speak comfort to Michael, sitting chin cupped, face tight. The words escape too fast. It will be better. Michael's eyes narrow. Like you know, I... Amy's hands fly to her mouth. I'm sorry. Forget it. Michael rushes upstairs, the bang of his bedroom door echoing into Amy's heart. What an idiotic thing to say. Go to him, a voice urges inside. I can't. Go. Amy nudges Michael's door open, met by wafts of cold air and smoke. Hey, please forgive me. Michael stabs his cigarette on the sill and wipes an eye. Whatever. You didn't know. She navigates the bog of clothes, her toe hitting something hard, and she digs it out. Your guitar. Can't bring myself to play. Amy sits on the floor, cradling his guitar. The neck's wider than hers, but its wood gleams, and the chord she strums resonates. Sing to me, Michael says. Amy tenses, her fingers on the frets. What? Anything. All right. And it comes, an old hymn, gentle. She sings in her honeyed alto, just as I am, without one plea, Lamb of God, I come, I come. He's mouthing along. The final strum shimmers, and Michael uncovers his tears. I miss her. Then Amy gathers Michael into a hug, smoothing his hair and his shudders, pressing his shoulders, and Michael cries into the curve of Amy's neck, his tears wetting her throat and Amy tasting the salt of her own. He lifts his face, mouth open. Michael kisses Amy. Caught. She softens, returning it, yet her spine tightening, awaiting recoil. This press, this mingled breath, her friend kissing like he wants her to touch his deeper parts and she his own. She knows the question he's really asking. Somebody, tell me I'm okay in this darkness. Love me. And he pulls at her sweater, stroking skin, the fine catch of his calluses snagging on her hip. And he stops, traces the old raised lines there. Curious, gentle, scars. No! Amy breaks away, an arm tight over her belly. Why'd you never tell me? Michael says. I didn't want you to worry. Amy shuts her eyes. Under her perfect high school mask, Amy barely breathed. Air came at age 15 when she sliced her thighs, and strange relief oozed out with the blood, but hips hit the cuts. And he lays his arm in Amy's lap. Look, everybody has a wound. Everybody has a scar. So she beholds it, the healing red gouges, angry pinpricks of removed stitches, marks earned when his uncle stabbed there, when Michael defended his grandmother's life, and she traces every line. Michael, hush. They fall back together, and like breath, Michael whispers in her ear, I like you, and her heart beats. Me too. What's wrong? Nothing. I'm afraid, Amy, but you need time to mourn, time to heal. But I'm alone. You're not, Michael. I'm here, even as a... Amy looks away, a friend. He takes her hand, then stay. And how good to hold, as Amy lilts a lullaby and Michael falls asleep, holding even as sleep loosens his hold and a car rumbles finally home. Amy kisses his forehead. I love you. And his eyelid flickers. Did he hear? She lets go. Amy sits bald on the landing. Footsteps creak on the stairs and Annie comes beside and she asks her, how is it? Amy's throat seizes, no words. Tears come, and Annie presses her close. I'm here. Grief asks for presence. Sometimes it is enough to have touched. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Sabrina. Next up, we have Chris Madden reading The American Acropolis. Chris.
This is my first time reading anything like this, so should be interesting. Manhattan, February 1999. Is there enough light? Melissa Tanaka asked her cameraman for the fifth time that Anya could hear. She thought of that if she were in the man's shoes, she would have already broken down and told that anchor that if she didn't stop asking, he was going to put the camera somewhere where the light rarely showed. But these two must have worked together for a long time, because all he did was politely nod and mutter that she was fine, that the camera would pick her up just fine. Tanaka returned the nod with one of her own and went back to absentmindedly looking around as she had before. Tanaka and her cameraman were set up across the street from City Hall. They were about to speak a little about some ongoing budget crisis in the city, as if something like that didn't happen every other week. It would be a quick little story, or at least it would be if Anya didn't gather up her courage and hijack, for lack of a nicer term, the story. As she was contemplating what she was about to do, a light breeze blew through the street, causing her body to double over in protest. Her teeth clattered rebelliously. She told herself that this was all for the because of the late winter cold snap. This wasn't a lingering sense of fear at the task before her. Now, if she could only figure out a way to make herself believe that. Snap. Anya whirled around so fast, she would have betrayed the fact that she wasn't human if anyone had been paying attention to the quote-unquote young Russian beauty. Looking around quickly for any sign of someone staring at her in disbelief or coming to get her, she eventually determined that she must have been hearing things. The knowledge didn't make things any easier. In fact, she was more on edge than ever. Turning back to stare at the duo, she found herself sighing and secretly wishing they had seen her little superhuman display of speed and agility just then. Then she would have had no excuse not to go through with her insane plan. Guessing that she had about 5 minutes before the cameras started rolling, she would have to decide if she was really going to commit to this plan. She plopped herself down on a nearby bench to calm her mind and to try to get a sense of normalcy back to her life. Probably, a voice in the back of her mind said, "The last moments of normalcy you'll ever have." She quickly tried to shove those thoughts out of her mind, without much success. She was not used to these feelings of worry, fear, dread, to emotions like these feeding on her thoughts. For hundreds of years, she had been considered by all one of the strongest creatures in existence. She had always been the ones who placed those feelings in other people. She had always thought she herself was above these feelings. Therefore, a weaker species was the mantra she had lived by for so long. It is for prey to feel, not predators. This was the mantra that was shared by all of her species, the vampires. For the past century, however, she had come to realize that this was not true. She had realized it ever since Armenia. But unfortunately, she was the only one. There was the serious issue of her husband. Sometimes she would wonder, if he had been in Armenia with her, would he have come to the same conclusion? Would she be doing the things she had to do now? If he had been there, would he have changed as well? She shook her head. No. Even if he had been there, it wouldn't have changed him. That's not who he was. Her husband was still the same as ever. As much as Anya had come to realize that a world without her husband would be a much better place, she couldn't bring herself to kill him. Not yet, at least. But she was afraid she would have to do it soon. Her son Eric was already dangerously close to his father. He was starting to sound like her. It scared her. And if her daughter kept on being around him, no, she couldn't do it. She was worried she would lose them both. She couldn't let that happen. That was why she had to risk it all on this one gamble. She looked up again. Melissa was getting into position in front of City Hall. This is it. The moment of truth. Anya stood up and took in a cold, shaky breath. Putting one foot forward, she prepared to walk into the streets until a hand grabbed her roughly by the arm and pulled her backwards. Anya was quickly pulled out of the busy street and back onto the sidewalk. She quickly grabbed the hand that was pressing on her and snapped it so violently that if the hand had belonged to a regular human, the hand would not have been able to be saved. Unfortunately, the person to whom the hand did belong was not a normal human. It was the hand of her husband's chief operative, werewolf, Hector Lemire. As Anya extradited herself from the man, she could see the bones popping back into his place. Hoping that she was doing a good job of concealing how close to freaking out she was, she desperately tried to make simple conversation. "Hector, what are you doing around here?" "I was feeling the same. I was quite surprised to see you here," he said with all the appearance of sincerity, but Anya didn't buy the facade for a second. He was here on her husband's orders. How could he be otherwise? Lord knows the man never sneezed without the express permission of Nikolai Masters. That could only mean that Nikolai was starting to realize the change in her behavior and was starting to develop contingencies for it. With a sinking stomach, Anya realized that the plan was not going to work. Not today, at least. Hector would make sure she failed. The old wolf continued fake smiling at her. "You know, my car is just around the corner. Why don't you and I go to that coffee house down the block? What was it, Jake's? Something like that? You can tell me stories about Eric and Jenna. How are they doing? I haven't seen them in so long. What is she now, 3? She's got to be getting so big." It sounded friendly, but she could see his fangs starting to grow. Anya suppressed a shudder. She didn't doubt for a second that Nikolai would allow Hector to hurt the kids if he thought it would keep her in line. So she kept on smiling and responded, "You know what? That sounds good. I wasn't really feeling like taking the subway today." She hoped the desperation wasn't showing through the cracks. Must not have been. Hector simply smiled, turned, and walked away. After a few agonizing moments, Anya's own legs started to move again. Her brain, having taken a sudden leave of absence from her body, decided to move as well. As she walked behind the wolf, her supernatural hearing allowed her to hear one last thing before they walked off. "Thank you, Jack. I'm standing in front of City Hall, where the news is nothing has happened today. Unfortunately, the mayor and the council has not come to an agreement. We just have to wait and see what happens tomorrow."
All right. Thank you, Chris. Next up, we have Isabel Alexander reading The Orange Door and A Game of Protocol. Isabel.
First, I'm going to read from a little short piece from The Orange Door. It's a mystery. "What do you need to know?" Philip said. "Ask away." I'm an open book, he added, turning toward the detective. Have you had a good relationship with Josh? We didn't have a relationship. Why should we? Do you mean if we were friends? Or friendly, Nick corrected. I don't remember seeing much of him at all. He looked up, as if trying to find the number of times written on the ceiling. Maybe once or twice I met him. Do you recall anything about those occasions that might be important? I don't know, Philip said slowly. I remember one of them was on the birthday party. Sammy had just turned one. Josh was there, and he made himself look so important, almost as if he was the godfather or something. Interesting, Nick said. In what way would you say he did that? Like he had to be in all of the pictures with Sammy and Evelina. I was kind of like, hey, dude, are you trying to take over? But I was leaving anyway, so I didn't say anything. He seemed a little too soft, a guy who doesn't know hard work. You know what I mean? It looked like his hands never been dirtied. When he drank from a cup, his pinky was like stuck out there like this, Philip explained, and mimicked drinking from an invisible cup, holding his pinky away from the rest of his fingers. I understand, Nick said, keeping his face straight, but I could tell he almost smiled. If you ask me, that guy was like a vulture, waiting to swoop in on his prey. A vulture? Yeah, like that bird that feeds on dead animals, a huge bird predator, the one that knows you are going to die in the desert, and it keeps following you. So when you do finally pass out, it starts to eat you before a jackal could. And sometimes the dude is not even dead yet, but this bird already taking his eyes out. Philip, I cut in, please stop saying things like that. Oh, you mean a vulture, Nick corrected. Okay, I think I have that picture. Clearer than it needed to be, I added. I was surprised that Evelina passed him off for that construction guy because Josh seemed like a smart guy. But then again, I know Lena likes guys who are strong and not afraid of little dirt and grime. Josh was too soft. I didn't think he had a spine. The next short piece is from the Game of Protocol. Okay. Where are you going? He hissed and grabbed my hand. I felt him squeeze hard. Don't break it. I'm going to have a drink, I whispered into his ear. But don't worry, I will eat the olives out of the martini. With that, I pulled my hand away and walked straight, balancing the 4.5-inch heels I wore to please. I hated high heels that pushed my toes forward and scrunched them together, inflicting pain. It gave him a reason to later rub them, disguising his need to touch my feet as a kind of kind gesture. I asked for the drink, dry with extra olives, from the handsome man behind the counter. It's my birthday, I said, and smiled, as if I had the best of time. There was nothing distinguishing about my looks. I could have been out celebrating another year of growth and maturity, as if it was something worth celebrating. But in my view, getting older meant becoming less desirable to men who could afford to buy a young woman from overseas and have her cater to all of his needs. Sit down, a strong whisper came from behind, hands grabbing my waist. His speech sounded as if he was planning a conspiracy and didn't want anyone else to hear, but yet wanted to bring a point across that was urgent for the cause. Is that the protocol? I said, glancing back behind my shoulder. Does it call for rude gestures and obscenely ugly expressions? His face got even sterner, and I could see his eyes squint, his jaws tighten, and his lips pressed together, almost disappearing. What happened? The cat bit your tongue? I mean lips. I teased and let out a small laugh. I gazed back at the handsome server, and my smile got even wider. The young bartender eyed me with admiration. I figured he must have liked my perceived status or the revealing, sparkling dress. It looked as if I had been molded of silver, a statue that one could put on a mantle and admire like something of value but my word was only a plane ticket from Ukraine, a fridge for my mother back home, and room and board for me to stay here in the States at his place. My hair pulled up into a bun on the top of my head, shiny. The red paint had made it look much more exotic than my normal, plain dark brown hair. He had taken me to the salon the week before, wanting me to have a perfect appearance. I didn't mind, since it hadn't cost me anything, only my pride. Since what he desired, it wasn't me. It wasn't the me that I knew. He could have cared less about what was in my mind or heart or soul. He didn't care for my knowledge I had possessed, only wanted me to look good in the dress. I quit law school because of his request. Thank you.
Next up we have Alicia reading Seaside.
So I spent most of today sleeping due to a migraine. I'm a little out of it, but I'll try to read not too slowly. Seaside. The water rushed over her body, through her skin in electric streams. With each oncoming wave of cool, salty brine, Lendl plunged in, arms stretched ahead and fingers pointed. The water flowed through her hair, against her back, and down her legs. As the wave rolled over her, she curved her body up to break the surface for a gulp of air, and again she plunged into the following wave. Each wave brought a new rush of energy. Each impulse coursed through her like electric ripples conducted by a neuron. Piercing the frothy liquid, her body reveled in the pulses, the power of the water rolling toward the shore. She pushed off the soft sand bottom with her toes, fighting the current that reflected her undulating movements. The pace at which her body moved forward matched the speed of the waves moving against her. She swam in place, a long banner rippling in the fluid wind like a serpent. The moon painted the sand silver as Lendl stretched out on her back in the wet sand, water lapping at her feet. The rhythmic sound of the waves drummed against the shore, complemented the wind rustling through the trees that marked the end of the beach and beginning of the forest. The morning birds began their shrill song, jolting Lendl from her thoughts. Ebba would wake up soon. She hoisted herself up reluctantly from the cool sand and ran down the coast, the sea expanding into the horizon on her left, toward a small structure visible in the foggy distance. There was a tiny sliver of light rising above the sea's horizon, painting everything in pale blush, and the bird's song crescendoed. The one-story house sagged slightly, the white-painted wood splintered in the corners of the small front porch, which ran along three of the four outer walls around to the rear of the house. The arcade columns supporting the porch were connected at their tops in arches, and the dark blue front door mimicked the rounded shape. Lendl tiptoed past the front door, doubled over below the thick glassed windows, and followed the porch to the back door. She opened it slowly and squeezed through the threshold without pushing it to the point where she knew it creaked. She had just clicked the door closed behind her when there was a rustling of bedsheets from her aunt and uncle's bedroom, from behind the second door on the right of the narrow hallway. She slipped through the first door into her bedroom just as she heard a door glide open and her aunt's light footsteps near her room. She slid beneath her soft reddish-brown sheets, careful to make no noise, and squeezed her eyes shut just as her aunt entered. "Good morning, Angel," Ebba whispered in her sing-song voice. Lendl groggily opened her eyes and her aunt leaned over her and pressed her lips to her forehead, her long brown braid falling over her shoulder onto her niece, the end tickling Lendl's shoulder. She straightened abruptly and ran her fingers through Lendl's hair. "Lendl, hide." "Ebba," Lendl retorted lethargically, but with a tone of playful mocking. "Don't you try to deceive me, you pesky little thing. You've just gotten into this bed, and you'll have to change the sheets again." "Oh, Ebba, the sheets are fine." Lendl yawned and stretched her arms out from under them. "Well, you're not going to sleep now. You had plenty of time to sleep all night. Get up and get dressed." Her aunt stooped down again and prodded her side through the covers. "All right, all right," Lendl laughed shrilly and pushed her aunt's hand away. She began to lift herself as Ebba left the room, but dropped back down into the damp pillow as soon as her footsteps faded down the hall. Lendl closed her eyes and listened to the muffled murmuring of her guardians as they began to move around the house. Her uncle was back then. It was him she had seen landing, arriving late at night. Lendl smiled to herself. Maybe he'd brought her something. She allowed her body a few fleeting moments of recuperating rest and then pried her eyes open, staring at the band of light spilling diagonally across the ceiling from between the light blue curtains hanging in her window. She hoisted herself up and reluctantly threw her legs over the edge of the bed. The thin layer of sand that covered the whole floor of her bedroom felt good against the dry soles of her feet as she drifted across the room to her dresser. She pulled on her long, dark green dress with lime-colored stitching. The material draped gently around her calves. Turning to the side in front of a large mirror above a pine desk, Lendl adjusted the ruche of fabric at her midsection. The green material puckered a little on her chest even when she tried adamantly to smooth it down. It didn't sit right like it used to. She gave up with one last irritated tug. The unruly mop on her head caught her attention. This wouldn't do, not for Ebba. With the premonition to avoid being sent back to her room to make herself look decent for breakfast, Lendl combed her damp, sand-filled hair with her fingers, finally pulling the short, dark tresses behind her ears and attempted to tame the thick fringe that fell down over her dark eyebrows. She brushed the sand off her pale face and pulled off the long grain stuck in the long lashes, framing her greenish-blue eyes. Satisfied with the result, she turned to her heel and headed down the hallway toward the front of the house.
Thank you, Alicia. Now we'd like Ann Anderson to come back up and read a poem for us.
This is a poem that's going to be published in volume 2 of a new local publication for writerly things. I'm not sure if they've come up with a name for it yet. It's called Depression. I drift in the tepid present along a passive stream of gray thought, alone inside the room in my mind with the closed doors I never think to open. I avoid their prickly eyes, words that scrub my soul bare. Reality bleaches my flawed bones and burns their image into the night theater where life critics rave about choices I did not make. From the chairs of their living room lives, how simple, the map of my past like a beacon to their unobstructed judgment. I drift in the murky dark. Their light does not show me their way.
Thank you, Anne. Pearl, you're up.
This one is entitled. By the time my body hit the ground, my soul had already escaped. And in that moment of mere seconds, the scene of my body plunging towards the earth below was somehow infinite. In hindsight, I knew this is how it was going to end all along. The warning signs of a volatile, tragic ending were there, constantly slapping me in the face. But you know what they say about love. It makes you blind. It can make you crazy. This was definitely the case when it came to Damien Stagg. I met Damien exactly 1 week to the day prior to my death. He was every bit the intense, confident, meticulous, and charming embodiment of a cold-blooded killer. It was virtually impossible to deny him any command he asked of me. With my own free will, I gave myself to him. The first time we met, I was on break in a little coffee shop on the corner where I was barely making ends meet. He called me coming out of the restroom and insisted on buying me coffee and taking me out that very night. I told him I was already in a relationship, but that did not deter him. He leaned in close, grabbed me by the waist, and pushed me gently against the wall, using his pelvis to hold me in place. I could feel the sweat gather on my top lip and the heat rise inside me. That wasn't a request. Be ready, Kara. Be ready for anything, he told me in my ear, voice low and seductive. His scent so intoxicating it should have been bottled up and sold at $100 an ounce. My body trembled and a pleasant ache began to course through me. By the time I opened my eyes, he was already exiting the door of the coffee shop and my breathing still hadn't returned to normal. That night, he picked me up right on time. Looking back now, I don't even remember exchanging any information with him. No address, not even a phone number.
But that didn't matter with Damien. He was resourceful and all-knowing in every aspect of his conquest. When the driver opened the door for me, his gaze studied me head to toe, and I felt like a lamb staring at a hungry wolf. He took me to one of the most exclusive spots in the city. We didn't wait in line and were guided with our own private waitress to a corner table roped off from the rest of the nightclub. I thought I was inwardly feeling guilty about canceling my plans with a guy I newly just met on one of those dating websites. I couldn't help but feel like a princess. As if sensing my plight, Damien leaned in and kissed my neck, pulling me back to the sound of the music surrounding us. Without hesitation, he pulled at my black mini skirt slightly, exposing just a bit more of thigh, kneading my skin as his hands went higher and higher. Thank God the table obscured our exchange. I felt my breath quicken and the music began to be muffled with the rushing of blood in my ears. Now I know what you might be thinking at this point. You were asking for it, slut. That's what you get. Couldn't you tell he was crazy? No normal guy acts that way. Yes, yes, all those points are valid, but what you may have forgot, Damien was a force to be reckoned with. The energy surrounding him was like a black hole, completely inescapable, and quite frankly, you didn't want to leave. From what I had learned about him in the car ride over, chauffeured, I might add, he was a successful businessman in some underground business of trades and conquerors of inadequate opponents. He talked nonchalantly about the whole thing, but none of that interests me since all I could concentrate on was his mouth, smooth, taut, and perfect. He didn't ask a whole lot of questions about me as it seemed like he had already read my life story. Small-time girl moving to the big city to escape, dying to prove everyone home, back home wrong. I won't have to sell my soul to survive here, I told my mother just before I left for the train station. His finger massaging the thin layer of fabric separating my womanly essence from his touch pulled me back and I could feel the aching deep within me. Turning to me, I caught a glimpse of his eyes and for a second, I thought I saw a flame. But before I could dwell, his lips were on mine and I could taste, feel, and smell and breathe him. That one kiss was the most intoxicating experience of my life and I knew the lamb had walked into the lion's den.
Thank you, Pearl. Next up is Isabel.
This is a short fiction called Symbols to Decipher. He smoothed the red comforter he had used as a canvas over the twin-size bed. He stood and studied the contrast of the black and blue letters and signs painted on the color of blood, the representation of life and love. The pattern of mathematical symbols wouldn't mean much to the uninformed mind, but to a genius, it was perfection. Tomorrow, he would work on the matching shams. You need love in your life, his mother had said before she died. He was 30 then, and still a virgin. Now, a decade later, the likelihood of finding a girl who could feel for him that which he didn't feel for himself seemed unattainable. He had stopped trying. What's the use? He closed the window after the odor of paint had aired out and washed his hands in the bathroom, looking into the mirror, examining his stern expression. Why wasn't he feeling elation? He expected a sense of satisfaction over the work he had done. But contemplating his image didn't help. His hair had turned silver. His face rounded out like a pizza. He looked more like his father now. He had been boastful of his DNA of the logical, superior mind, but had always wished that the physical aspects had been inherited from his mother. Curtains, he said to the man in the mirror. His father often had used that term when something seemed inevitable, or for behaviors mother didn't approve of, but he lacked discipline or determination to change. As a boy, he had asked him once what it meant. It's a theater term, his father explained. The play ended and the curtains are drawn. It's over. He shut off the water, wiped his hands methodically, and shuffled into the day room and glanced at his mementos all lined up above the fake fireplace among the pictures of the past. He grabbed one of the framed photos. His mother posing in coordinated attire red belt, hat, and handbag, in high heels, hugging his father. He traced his index finger over the glass on her red shoes, then her shoulder-length dark hair, and remembered the day when he brought home a girl that liked him in his 20s. "What was she thinking?" his mother said. "Was she trying to seduce your father? She should have pulled her hair up into a bun and wore flats. That would have been proper," she added, before banning her from his life. He reached for the figurine, a green frog, the last gift he had received for Christmas. He held it in his soft hands, nails bitten off to the flesh, and could smell the scent of pine, hear the soft classical music playing. He could see his mother's face watching him undoing the red bow, opening the neatly wrapped box. Her face filled with anticipation, her smile vague. She looked at him with eyes filled with guilt. He folded the wrapping paper. He knew she wanted it that way. Then he remembered what she told him on that same day in the morning when he had made her and handed her the chamomile tea he prepared. "You are an evil son," she said, and her eyes spoke that it was true. He sat and listened for an hour about her complaint of making her tea too early. He didn't talk back. He tried to block it out. He tried not to remember, but it permeated him as the dust of winter's frost attaching to the branches of a tree, no matter how small. The breast cancer had taken her soon after that, but no time could erase those words, "evil son." He would have to live through a lifetime knowing that he could never be loved.
Thank you, Isabel. Next up, we have Gigi.
So, basically, my story's title is Lucia and Calvin. Sunlight streamed in through the Venetian blinds as Lucia stretched her arms out all the way, arching her back for maximum release. Yawning wide enough to swallow her nemesis, she turned over luxuriantly. Lazily, she popped open an eye, glaring at the annoyingly perky pink walls. How dare they seem more awake than her? Grumpy and deliciously tired, she closed her eyes. She couldn't have cared less if the entire world was more alert than she was. She could sleep the morning away. After all, it was Saturday. No school, no work, nothing. She flipped onto her belly and rested her head in her hands, somehow managing to make herself look sleepy, elegant, and adorable simultaneously. Lucia was more than content to lie there for the rest of the day until she felt someone stirring next to her. Just enough to disrupt her sleepiness and chase away any dreams she'd begun remembering. Damn, they were good too. For some reason, she dreamt about T-boning a hairy, bushy beast with green eyes. Was it a cat? With a groan, Lucia popped open an eye again to glare at her boyfriend, Calvin. He didn't even have the decency to wake up next to her to bask in their sleeplessness. He was too busy snoring, just quietly enough to not sound like a train wreck, but loudly enough to be disruptive. Was he still dreaming? Well, she'd soon fix that. "Ow!" he yelped, turning to her and rubbing his backside where she'd kicked him. His tousled brown hair and glimmering green eyes were the two main reasons she tolerated him. Both qualities were enough to make one melt into putty, a fact he used to get away with hypothetical murder. Still, as far as boyfriends went, she could have done worse. Calvin might be moody, egotistical, pushy, and, according to some, psychotic, just ask the thief he chased out with nothing but a shoe, but he had his less abominable side. She knew deep down he loved her and would do anything for her. Besides, if he ever got too pushy, like plunking himself in the middle of the bed when he knew she was about to lie down, well, she knew how to put him in his place. Okay. It's based on my two pets, Lucia and Calvin. Lucia's my dog, Calvin's my cat, and yes, the story about Lucia T-boning Calvin down the stairs is true. That's happened multiple times.
Thank you, Gigi. Sheila will now read Devotion.
I sit in my chair with a cup of tea. A warm blanket covers me. Table on my left, soft morning light. Journal on my lap, pen poised to write. Good morning, Father, I say. How are you today? I listen for your voice to hear what you'll whisper in my ear. My heart senses your loving words. Peace be with you is what I heard. Fear not this day of clashing wills, for I am with you and love you still. Father, I am grateful and blessed. Though I'm far from perfect, I confess. I would run and crawl to follow you. My soul is yours, my heart is true. Father, you are holy and divine. I am yours, and you are mine.
Thank you, Sheila. Next up, Sabrina will be reading.
This is a poem called Caritas. Child, I know a light that can warm your bones. You, in the hovel there, no fire in the grate, the quilt too thin for words, colors grayed as if the rain washed it all dead. Trees as bare as anything, the longest, coldest winter. But do not fear, child. I will give you a home. I will have you sit by my hearth, and I will eat beside you at the fireside. I will clothe you and comfort you with blankets colorful and warm. I will hold you and hug you, child, and give you a home, if you wish. Walls strong enough to fight the cold, and a name joined to my name, if you like. It will be springtime and summertime again, growing and green. Child, will you come? Will you say yes? I'll be waiting, right here.
Thank you, Sabrina. Okay, I'm going to read something. It's me, Dan Evanson. Hi. This is an excerpt from my novel, A Witch in the Walls. The dirt was cold and clammy between Heather's toes as she stepped cautiously, looking for signs of life in the midst of the dark loam and fallen detritus of the trees. Some spaces were completely covered by the massive leaves of the canopy. The space between the trees here was larger than you would think when you spent your time between the limbs up above. She needed a place between several trees where the nutrients could still be found in the ground, where they hadn't been pulled into the trees and turned into sap for growing. The disk of light made by the torch passed over a piece of uneven ground, half covered by medium-sized leaves that were still 5 or 6 feet across. She cleared the leaves away, huffing at the weight of them, even as they crumbled partly to dust from the movement. Underneath, the torch revealed a small area of mushrooms sticking out of black soil. She bent down and gathered several handfuls of the red-capped and gray-streaked mushrooms into the bag she had brought. Heather stood and reattached the bag to the line around her waist. As she was about to switch off the torch, something reflected in the solitary disk of light. Eyes, burning gold in a field of black. A low growl came from the shadows surrounding those glowing eyes. A muzzle resolved itself into the space of the torch's light. A long, snouted canine face was propelled into the lit circle by a body of thick black fur. The body was supported on powerful legs, each tipped with bony protrusions and jagged sickle shapes. The claws twitched and scratched at the ground under them as the shadow dog came completely into view. The growl came from its open mouth, which revealed a black row of flat teeth leading toward a triple row of serrated fangs. As the volume of its growl increased, it lowered its head, the long pointed ears flattening. Heather could see glimmers of self begin to gather around its legs and claws. A shadow dog was one of the few creatures of the wild that could use itself to increase strength, agility, and its natural killing abilities. Most believed it must have some level of consciousness and intelligence to use self, but looking into those golden eyes, Heather could perceive only hunger and hatred. She barely heard the attack before the unseen dog behind her tried to lay its claws into her spine. Heather shot forward, straight towards the first dog, while the claws of the second whistled through the space she had just occupied. She landed apace in front of the first dog and slid in the loose, stinking black soil where the mushrooms were growing. She nearly lost her balance in the slide as the dog in front of her reared up to cut her down. She leaned back, letting the clawed paw sail over her, the sharpness of its self-empowered claw singing as it cut the air. Heather contorted her body to dodge its angular attack, and as she passed it, she snapped forward and jumped. She landed feet first into the nearest tree and latched herself into the loose bark. Hanging on the bark of the tree a few feet above the floor, she switched off her torch as she gathered herself back into her eyes. Now that she was fighting shadow dogs, the pale light of the torch was a hindrance. Darkness settled into the area again, and the eyes of the two shadow dogs glowed even brighter with golden hatred. A third set of eyes now moved between the first two. As they arrayed evenly around her, thin lines began to glow in their fur. Phosphorescent spirals wrapped all around the bodies of the dogs. The light of the dogs wasn't strong, but in the complete darkness, and with little focus through the use of herself, she could see them clearly. When a shadow dog was stalking, it was nearly invisible here on the darkness of the floor. When it had cornered prey, the pack revealed itself with the phosphorescent markings just before it struck. Once it had caught a scent, a pack of shadow dogs would never give up the hunt. She couldn't run. She had to fight. Something dripped onto her neck. She almost reached up to feel at the slimy material, but she realized her mistake and launched herself from the center of the tree. Light bloomed behind her as a fourth dog dropped from above her former position, snapping its serrated bite at her back. It dug its claws into the bark of the tree to stop its fall, just as Heather spun her body into a kick that laid out the first dog. Heather slid past the other two, sinking a hand into the soil of the floor to stop her momentum. The other three dogs watched her as their fellow crashed to the floor and settled into the detritus. Slowly, its glow faded and its shape was lost to darkness. The dog hanging from the tree howled as the other two leapt for Heather with self-powered legs. They were blurs of phosphorescent blue. Heather had no hope of dodging them, but she also had no interest in doing so. The closer dog tried to slash her with its jagged bone claws, but they struck her hardened self and shattered from the force of the dog's own attack. Blood and marrow splattered Heather even as the jaws of the other dog closed around her throat. The dog settled its forelegs on her shoulders and its rear legs on her stomach while it tried to wrench loose her neck. Instead, the dog met only her hardened self. Numerous serrated teeth from the dog's mouth fell around her as it tried to rip her apart. Heather made herself a living statue by hardening herself and sinking hook-like shapes off her feet into the ground. She softened the self around her arms and brought them together with a clap under the dog. A collision of self created a concussive blast that shattered the air and knocked the shadow dog off her body. The first two dogs began to move in opposite directions now. They were trying to circle her. She softened herself with the exception of her fingertips. The thickened self formed around her fingertips and down the blade of her hand. Heather waited until they were on either side of her, waited for them to crouch, and then she ran straight forward toward the nearest tree, using herself to run straight up the rough bark of the tree and escape. We still have a little time left, so I'm going to take orders from the floor. If anybody wants, you know, it's your last chance to read another one. Isabel, you want a short poem? Mm-hmm. Go for it.
A constructive state of mind. I see yellow butterflies and crimson dahlias. The scent of petunias penetrates my nostrils, telling me life is wonderful. I'm determined to believe the lies of safety of a greenhouse full of the miracles of God, but I grumble as I walk cautiously among the strawberry-colored azaleas. She's the queen among these flowers, but I'm a peasant, an opossum decaying falsely just for a moment until peace descends and short-circuits the troubles of daily life and the longings of my heart, and I dare to celebrate being alive. The sparkle of a teardrop, the emanating light through the windows of my soul, better for attention, knowing that light will evaporate even the strongest storms and highest waterfalls. I merely must let in the blaze to scorch the uncertainty and anguish of life and transform it into acceptance and a yearning for the wisdom of higher power and learn to adore what my eyes cannot see. The sweet smell lulls me into a state of joy, an intangible promise of beauty, and I can walk the path. I can take each step toward my dreams and open up to a purposeful, constructive state of mind. Life is an experience. Life is full of promises, and I am one of them.
All right, so thanks very much, everybody, for coming out tonight. I think we all can say thank you again to all our readers. We hope you had a good time, and we'll see you next year for NaNoWriMo 2018. Good night.